It is Tuesday, November 18th, 2014, and you are listening to The Kickabout. The Kickabout is the Nationals podcast focusing on football in the UAE, and it is part of the Extra Time series. I am your host, Paul Freeland, and joining me today is Paul Oberjergi, sports editor of The National. Paul, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Paul. Happy to be here.
As you no doubt don't need me to tell you, the Gulf Cup of Nations is in full swing. Let's start with Group B, the one that's going to interest most of our listeners. You know, the UAE and Oman opened on Friday with a 0-0 draw that wasn't exactly inspiring, save for Ali Al-Habsi doing what Ali Al-Habsi does best, ruining other people's fun. And Iraq and Kuwait in the late match, they nearly matched that performance drab for drab until Fahad Al-Anizi's dramatic 90th-minute winner. And then on Monday, it was probably the most energetic performance out of the UAE in quite some time, unless you were among the select few who happened to see that 3-2 friendly win over Lebanon. The UAE came back, came to life. They went 2 goals ahead over Kuwait, but then they handed that lead back almost as quickly. They drew 2-2. Then Iraq and Oman drew 1-1 in the late match. So Kuwait, after two matches, they top Group B with 4 points, winning a draw. The UAE and Oman level on 2 points, although the UAE had the edge on goals scored, and Iraq sitting last in the group with one. Paul, we'll start with the UAE. How encouraged should UAE fans be by that brief revival against Kuwait, or should they be more concerned by the three halves of scoreless football that were sandwiched around that brief revival?
I think there should be some encouragement there, but in sort of a negative way, in the sense that it was as if Kuwait had never heard of Omar Abdulrahman. On the two goals, he was curiously unmarked, especially the first, where he danced by one guy, and then he was just in open green territory. I'm fairly certain that Iraq, which is a robust and a big team, and just physically large, will make a point of running people at Omar. Kuwait got around to hacking him down and beating him up. I think Iraq will do that from the start. I don't think he will get the chance to make that sort of run that led to the really memorable first goal. What was encouraging, however, and I think maybe a little bit overlooked, in that Ali Mabkut, who scored the two goals, both of those were really nice goals. The first was a sort of chip after he stepped back from the one defender in his way. And the second was a fairly heavily struck ball from the edge of the box in the upper right-hand corner. If he's got that scoring touch back, that's encouraging, especially with many of the others really struggling to get the ball in the net.
Oh, sure. And to give you a sign of just how close run the tournament's been so far, those two goals have Ali Mabkut as the golden boot leader thus far. So he has that going for him, which is nice. But I think looking at it overall, I mean, Omar can't help but be the center of attention, whether he plays well or he plays poorly. I think one of the bits that most people are talking about is he seems to be developing this habit of coming back into his own half to get the ball. Now, it's not sure whether it's he feels the need to do more in order to lift the team, if he's trying to do too much, or if his teammates are heaping that responsibility on him because they know he's the man. I mean, how much is this affecting the way the UAE plays Omar, having to go do his own piano carrying as well as piano playing?
It definitely is a load on him. He prefers, I mean, all things being equal, to sort of glide in and out of games, not necessarily like detaching himself, but not having to be the guy who carries the ball 50 meters every time they gain possession. I think we cannot underestimate how tightly the national team is controlled by Mahdi Ali. Omar would not be retreating deep into his own half to pick up the ball from Kamis Ismail or one of the defenders and carry it forward if Mahdi Ali had not instructed him to do so, which suggests to me that the coach does not trust the rest of his side to get the ball successfully into the attacking half and then to Omar. And I think maybe also it could be something as simple as, let's have Omar carry it against midfielders at least for the first 20 meters before he runs into the guys in the back who are going to jostle him and knock him around.
For me, anyway, it's really reminiscent of watching the Japanese national team back when Hidetoshi Nakata was there pulling the strings. You got everyone deferring to the one big guy in midfield. Well, world-class talent, to be sure, but it seems like by deferring to him, they're also kind of relieving themselves of a responsibility to pick up the slack and make something happen on their own. And you're right, maybe they're told to do that, but I mean, that all it takes is a few well-placed kicks to that wonky knee of his, and then the wheels could really come off the wagon quickly. So on Thursday, as you mentioned, the UAE take on Iraq in the group finale, while Kuwait face Oman simultaneously. And with the group as it is, the one thing the UAE can't afford to do is lose. So how do you think they'll approach this last group match, Paul?
I think they'll approach it very carefully, very conservatively. Mahdi Ali knows that just getting to the semifinals is his first goal. I think the display we saw last night, which was just almost exhilarating for 45 minutes, three very fine goals. We shouldn't expect that in this one. I think it'll be very low scoring. I think nil-nil is very possible. They'll be following the other match to see if one of those teams, Oman in particular, gets to any kind of goal total. But yeah, they will be following that closely. I think they'll be very conservative. They may come forward cautiously. The UAE will, but Iraq has to win. So they will be tilted toward the defensive and a defensive posture. And so it could be a very tactically heavy, not particularly interesting to the average fan sort of match. It may be kind of a negative one as well. All they need, though, possibly, is that one point.
If Mahdi Ali tells his team to soak up pressure and play on the counter, can they do that?
I'm sure they can. If while watching them last night, everyone dropped back except Ahmed Khalil. Ali Mabkut was making defensive plays in his own box. Omar was on the edge of the box. I mean, everyone came back except Ahmed Khalil, and that was just, so they could leave him a little bit forward and keep two defenders near him or around him. That's in a game where they were coming to win. When they are planning to maybe aim for a tie, I think they will have absolutely no problem getting 10 men in front of the ball for long stretches of the match.
And we'll touch on Group A briefly here. In the opener, Saudi Arabia and Qatar opened with a 1-1 draw, and then Yemen and Bahrain drew 0-0. And then second round of matches there, Yemen drew 0-0 with Qatar on Sunday, and that gave them their best Gulf Cup performance ever, for them anyway, with 2 points. In their 6 previous appearances, the best they managed was 1 point, and when they were the hosts, they lost all 3 of their matches, so that's a feather in their cap, if nothing else. Now, the Saudis top Group A with 4 points after 2 rounds of play, after their 3-0 win over Bahrain, with the increasingly popular Nasser Al-Shamrani opening the scoring for 2 Bahraini defenders decided to get in the goal-scoring act, albeit at the wrong end. And Qatar and Yemen are level in second with 2 points, and Bahrain last on 1. And in the aftermath of that loss to Saudi Arabia, Bahrain dismissed their Iraqi coach Adnan Hamad, leaving his assistant Murjan Aid to see out the tournament. On Wednesday, the Saudis closed group play against Yemen, who have yet to give up a goal, and also have yet to score a goal, while Bahrain faced Qatar. Paul, what do we make of Group A? Do you think Yemen can pull off one more shock result?
I think they've probably used up their total of miracles for this tournament. I've been impressed by their cohesion and their organization. They don't really seem to be really able to mount much of an attack. And as well as they have played, sometimes we forget about some of the political realities too. I mean, Yemen internally right now is in quite a lot of upheaval, and it's fun and sort of refreshing, and that when teams in that situation can come in and play well and perhaps give some sort of boost to just the average folks back home who are going through a hard time. But they're playing Saudi in Riyadh, and there will be going to be 60,000 Saudi fans at that match. They will fully expect to win. They're much better man for man. I expect them to not be negative, to play as if they expect to win, and I believe that they will. The other match is a little more interesting. Bahrain clearly has been hurt by the loss of several of their players that were stars on the two teams that came within a whisker of getting to the World Cup. I'm not sure they're awful. I think there's issues between their ears right now, mental issues. I think they could give Qatar some trouble. They certainly have not been impressive particularly. So that group could still turn out with, I think, any of the four, but especially any of the three that aren't Yemen.
Mm. And then just real briefly, you mentioned the potential attendance for the Saudi-Yemen match. Just looking at the pictures from the broadcast, there are lots of swaths of empty seats. I mean, is that necessarily a surprise with the tournament being in Saudi, which is not exactly the easiest place to get to? Do we take anything away from, I guess, the banks of empty seats, or is that just to be expected for non-Saudi matches in Saudi?
I think that's to be expected for non-Saudi matches in Saudi. The UAE Football Association has, with Etisalat, has arranged to have five jets going over to each of the UAE matches, and they have a fairly representative crowd. There have been quite a few Yemenis in matches as well. I think we can't really expect thousands of people to go over for each of the three group matches. What I have found a bit surprising is Saudi's own fans not necessarily showing up, especially for the opening match when there were lots of empty seats. I would think that may change now that they're leading the group and look very likely to make the semifinals. And if they do that, then I'm sure, I'm not sure, but I'm fairly positive they'll fill the stadium. I have a theory that the thing about the Gulf Cup is that it may be the most interesting and most significant football tournament involving any of the regional teams. Everyone aspires to the World Cup. None of these teams have made it since Saudi in 2006 at Germany. The Asian Cup was something that teams used to be able to win. Saudi did it three times. Kuwait's done it once. Iraq did it in 2007. But that's probably a bridge too far right now with Japan playing as well as they do and South Korea and maybe North Korea and Australia and even China. This is something that somebody here is going to win. A local team is going to win, and that makes it a big deal. And these are neighbors. These are people you know. These are people in the Gulf Cooperation Council. This is a big deal. When you feel like you have a chance to win, the momentum and the energy behind you can be really impressive.
All right. Well, certainly we'll keep an eye out for the big finale in the next few days. Thank you for joining us on The Kickabout. This podcast was edited by Deepthi Unnikrishnan and produced by the Nationals Multimedia Desk. Follow the Multimedia Desk on Twitter at NSVUAE and the Sports Desk at SPRT National UAE. I'm Paul Freeland. Thanks for listening.